But what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. UN Syria envoy indicates peace talks remain on track. The UN envoy to Syria says the dispute between Iran and Saudi Arabia will not undermine efforts to resolve the conflict in Syria. Stefan de Mistura said Sunday after meetings with Saudi and Iranian foreign ministers separately that both assured him the row over the execution of a prominent Shia cleric by Riyadh will have no bearing on Geneva talks scheduled to get underway January 25th. While he believes the talks will resume later this month, regional analyst Abdul Qadir Sino of Indiana University doubts there will be any progress.
They all will play along. They will all go through the movements and pretend, you know, to be part of serious negotiations, but nothing serious will probably happen.
Sino says Syria believes with Russian and Iranian backing, it's gaining the upper hand in fighting on the ground. Meanwhile, in Cairo, senior Arab officials condemned what they called Iran's alleged meddling in Arab affairs. Emirati Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahan, speaking Sunday at an emergency Arab League session, said Iran could have resolved its differences with its neighbors with the same enthusiasm it reached a nuclear accord, but he said there's no similar seriousness. Saudi Arabia requested the session to discuss the attacks on its embassy in Tehran, which followed the kingdom's execution of a prominent Shia cleric, Nimr al-Nimr, early this month. Ghanaian authorities have arrested the fugitive partner of the late British soap opera actress C.N. Blake and plan to extradite him back to Britain. Police Inspector Prosper Ogblore said Sunday that Arthur Simpson Kent was apprehended near the seaside town of Butrus Saturday. The bodies of Blake and her two children were found last month in their southeast London neighborhood. They were last seen alive December 13. Simpson Kent left Britain shortly after being questioned by police. This is VOA News. U.S. actor Sean Penn met with legendary Mexican drug trafficker Joaquin El Chapo Guzman in Mexico months before his capture for an interview posted on Rolling Stone magazine's website last Saturday, just a day after Guzman was recaptured by Mexican authorities. Mark Jones of Rice University is a regional analyst.
It was probably inevitable in that El Chapo Guzman could run, but he couldn't hide. His escape severely embarrassed the Peña Nieto government. And at the same time, because of his ties to Mexico as well as his support base in Mexico, he really couldn't flee abroad. So he was in some ways trapped within Mexico and had to constantly stay ahead of a Mexican government, which had some U.S. help in trying to evade police.
Guzman's July 11th prison escape, his second in the past 14 years, was a point of friction between Mexico and the U.S., which had requested his extradition. Officials from Afghanistan, Pakistan, China, and the United States are to meet in Islamabad Monday to discuss ways to revive the peace process between Kabul and the Taliban to end 14 years of conflict. The Taliban has not been invited. A previous round of talks was suspended in July after news was received that the insurgent group's leader, Mullah Omar, had died 2 years earlier. A long-range U.S. B-52 bomber flew over South Korean territory Sunday following North Korea's latest nuclear weapons test. Troy Stangaron with the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute says what was done is essentially taken and demonstrated to North Korea that the U.S. remains committed to the defense of both South Korea and Japan, and that it has the means with which to take and defend them should North Korea decide to utilize its growing nuclear program for an attempt to take and either cause provocations on the peninsula or some other type of disruption toward either South Korea or Japan. Korean leader Kim Jong-un defended last Wednesday's test as the, quote, legitimate right of a sovereign state and a fair action that nobody can criticize. Meanwhile, the South has resumed propaganda broadcasts over the border toward North Korea. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has condemned the missile attack Sunday in northern Yemen that killed at least four at a hospital supported by the aid group Doctors Without Borders. The UN chief urged a prompt independent investigation to hold accountable those responsible for the attack on the Shiara Hospital in Saada province. South African President Jacob Zuma said markets overreacted to his decision to sack Nhlanhla Nene as finance minister last month. He told South Korean television people didn't understand the situation and exaggerated the issue. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, in for James Barty. Today's Monday, January 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Amid reports that thousands are fleeing violence in South Sudan's Equatorial State, rebels and government said that they have agreed on ministerial positions for a new transitional government. The government of Ethiopia has been criticized for its heavy-handed approach in cracking down on student protests in the Oromia region.
As the protests expand and reach all corners of the Oromo country, their demands have grown and now includes calls for genuine self-rule, for release of Oromo political prisoners.
Mohamed Ademu is an Ethiopian journalist and editor. And in Uganda, the diaspora are concerned about reports of voter intimidation by the ruling party of President Museveni. Those stories, plus Marco Umo's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The four signatories to the South Sudan peace deal have agreed on sharing ministerial portfolios. The transitional government of national unity will be formed on January 22nd. The government, Sudanese People's Liberation Movement in opposition, SPLM-IO, former detainees and other political parties recently came to an agreement under the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, JEMEC, led by former president of Botswana, Festus Mogae. Rayeth Moach Tang is the representative of the SPLM-IO in North America. I reached him in Washington and asked him why there had been some delays in forming the government of national unity.
The peace agreement set out the timetable of when the government of national unity will be in place. But I believe what is taking thing behind is the decision that was made by the government about the 28th state. If it was not because of the 28th state, we should have now the government of the national, the transitional government of national unity in place.
Is the opposition satisfied with this arrangement, this new arrangement?
Well, not really that the opposition is satisfied, but, you know, the opposition is really fully committed to the implementation of the peace agreement. And we actually want to bring peace because we have had the suffering of our people. That's why, even though the government on daily basis are violating the peace agreement, we wanted to make sure that we don't pull out from the implementation. We are pushing them and we are pushing the JMAC that the government will come to its end that they want to implement the peace agreement.
Now, when will the transitional government, when will it start officially working?
I cannot tell you exactly when it will be working, but the SPLM in opposition through the Adban team has submitted everything. We submitted the name of our nominated ministers, and you may have heard this today that the appointment of the 50 MP from the SPLM-IO, we have done everything, but the ball is on the goal of the government because the government is insisting on some part of the implementation. So I cannot tell you when exactly the national government will be in place, but in our side, we are ready.
What are some of the sticking points for the government? Why was there some hesitation on the part of the government?
Well, this is not a new thing. If you have been following what is going on in the peace agreement, you know, the government have reservation in the first place. You know that they have signed the peace agreement after 9 days, after the chairman of the SPLM in opposition have signed the peace agreement. It is not a new thing. We are just pushing our way that because the SPLM have learned that the suffering of the people, the government is not caring about what is happening to the people. They have been having all reservation all along when they signed the peace agreement. Now they have come up with the declaration of the 28th state, which is not in the agreement.
Now, the United Nations Refugee Agency recently reported that thousands of people in Western Equatorial State are still fleeing from the growing violence in the area, in the region. What can you tell us about what is happening in that area?
Yes, the government is still in operation. It is still making offensive against our forces, so that there is still fighting going on, but it's the government who is on offensive.
But so the government is attacking the rebel positions?
Yes. And any violation, we always present them in front of the JMAC and the IGAD country. We do that always.
Rayeth Mwachtang is the representative of the SPLM-IO in North America. He spoke to me from his office in Washington. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has apologized for his role in plunging the country into a conflict that left tens of thousands dead and many more displaced from their homes. The apology is a key demand in an agreement signed by President Kiir and his rival and former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar. Presidential spokesman Atenyi Wek told VOA's Peter Clotty that it would be wrong for critics to misinterpret the apology of the South Sudanese leader.
The apology of the president is taken out of context. The president did apologize as a requirement of the Arusha intra-party dialogue, which has actually concluded that the leaders of the SPLM, including the SPLM in government, the SPLM IO, the SPLM FDs, that are the political detainees, should apologize to the people of South Sudan because of the war they have engaged on, which has actually affected the people of South Sudan. And during the convention, the Arusha agreement was incorporated into the basic document of the SPLM, which is the guiding principle and the constitution. And the president apologized as a requirement of the agreement, because the agreement is a part of the peace agreement, okay, that brings it back into the party of the SPLM, the two factions of the SPLM, that's IO and the political detainees. So the president's apology was on the basis of Arusha agreement.
With the steps the president has taken so far, what does this leave the peace agreement?
Well, it can tell us the political will that the government has shown. I said it actually demonstrated the political will to implement the peace agreement in letter and spirit. And that's, you know, the president has now appointed the 50 members of the parliament who are actually the IO members, you know. And that indicates, you know, to the people of South Sudan that it is no longer a saying, but now it is an action.
With all these moves that the president has made, and you have defended the president saying that he's committed and he has the political will to end the conflict and to ensure the full implementation of the agreement signed with then-opponent, former Vice President Riek Machar. Former President Festus Mohai is saying that the unilateral formation of the 28 states basically is a hindrance to the full implementation of the same peace agreement that you said the president is committed to. How do you address this problem?
President Festus Mogae is the most respected African statesman, given his history as the president of Botswana, in which during his tenure, Botswana was seen to be one of the countries that has flourished democratically, and, you know, in terms of democracy and in terms of development of that country. However, his conclusion is a little bit, regrettable, because considering that the two parties or the three parties which are implementing the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan are seriously ready to implement, he should not be seen to be putting impediment on the implementation. Rather than seeing the parties agreeing, and they are now still together. So establishment of 28 states is no longer an issue between the SPLM-IO and the government. SPLM-IO have these in one hand and then the government in the other. So it's no longer an issue. They have passed this one behind them.
Following the end of the convention at which the president apologized to the people, when should we expect the full name of his government of national unity to move the country forward towards the next election?
Well, the formation of the government will not come to when Dr. Machar come to Juba. You know, Dr. Machar is still in Addis Ababa. He cannot be appointed the vice president while he's still in Addis Ababa. He should have to come to Juba following, his advanced team that was led by Thabang Dengai. And again, the agreement says the first vice president and the president of the republic plus the vice president, that in that case will be Comrade James Wanyika, would be sitting together and, you know, to consult among themselves before the formation of the government of national unity. So if Machar stays in Addis Ababa indefinitely, then the the coming of the transitional government will also be indefinite, will also be difficult to come to being if the Promachar is not in Juba.
Atenyi Wek Ateny is the spokesman for the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke to VOA's Peter Cloti from the capital, Juba. Human rights groups have criticized the government of Ethiopia for its heavy-handed response to the student protest in the Oromia region. Reports say that at least 140 people have been killed by police and security forces. The government says that five have been killed and accuses the protesters of seeking to destabilize the country. Mohamed Ademu is an Ethiopian journalist based in the U.S. He says that the government of Ethiopia has been simply unwilling to listen to the requests of the protesters.
The protesters are really happening in almost all corners of the Oromia state. Oromia is the largest of Ethiopia's nine linguistic-based federal states. And the protests started in mid-November over what authorities call a master plan to expand the capital city, Addis Ababa. But over the last 7 or 8 weeks, as the protests expand and reach all corners of the Oromo country, the demands have grown and now includes calls for genuine self-rule, for release of Oromo political prisoners and people who have been arrested over the last several weeks. And then also the protesters are calling for an independent investigation into the killings of more than 150 protesters in the last several weeks.
Are you satisfied with the reaction of the international community, specifically development partners like the U.S.?
I'm not a small bit surprised by the lack of really forceful response from the international community, because over the last two decades, the Western governments, particularly the U.S. government, has looked to Ethiopia as a stable force in the Horn of Africa region. And also, since Ethiopia's economy has allegedly grown at a much faster pace than it is neighbors, they had hoped that the government in Addis Ababa was actually on the right track. But the protesters seem to have caught both the government of Ethiopia and the international community by surprise, because there was a pent-up anger people have been feeling over the last 24 years. And it sort of just exploded. And it seems to me that people in Washington and Brussels and other places don't know exactly how they should respond to this, because the government have been telling them a different thing, a country that is growing fast, an ethnic federalism that supposedly allows people self-rule. But in reality, those things were just a window dressing. In reality, the federalism was not genuinely applied, and people did not feel that they were represented. And the economy was growing in the capital, but people in the peripheries did not benefit from some of the growth that have been reported. So I think people in the West are caught in a situation where they don't know how to respond to the situation.
And what is the status of some of the people that were arrested, some of the protesters? Is there a judicial process that has already started yet?
Well, Ethiopia is a police state, and the courts are really an extension of the executive government power, where people have been arrested. The constitution says that they should be brought to court within 48 hours. But for all we know, most of these people in thousands have not been brought to court. In a case in point, a man of peace who was just here in Washington, D.C. a couple of months ago, Bakala Garba, was arrested in mid-December, and is almost a month now that not a single person from his family has seen him. And we don't know yet if he has been brought to court. And there were reports that he's actually gravely ill and he was tortured. And apparently security forces took him to a hospital, but the family don't know the state of his health and his well-being. And, you know, as I said, the judiciary is not independent. And at this point, they've arrested so many people that the prisons are overflowing. And now we are hearing reports that people are being held at stadiums, at high schools and at colleges.
Has there been any attempt by the government of Ethiopia and the protesters to enter some sort of talks?
The government is used to talking down to the people from the top, and they have been using the media, which they control. The problem really is the federal government is saying one thing and the regional authorities are saying a different thing.
Now, what is the status of the protests at this moment?
At this moment, today, as we speak on Sunday, Monday morning in Ethiopia, we are hearing reports of students being beaten at Madawalabu University, which is in southeastern Ethiopia in the Bale region. About two students were killed this morning there. And we are also hearing reports in western Oromia at Jimma University, where students are being severely beat. In photos of these reports are circulating on social media. Again, you know, it's the start of a week there. And we expect that there is going to be more protests over the week. And people are really concerned because the government is not really coming to its senses, despite the fact that people have said no.
Mohamed Ademu is a journalist and editor of Opride. He was speaking to me from Washington. Ugandans in the diaspora are closely following development in their country's electoral process, and many are concerned about allegations that incumbent President Yoweri Museveni is using intimidation and violence against opposition politicians and their supporters. Martin Byakureka is a Ugandan activist based in Boston. He says that even though the diaspora is not allowed to vote, they are fully engaged in the process and intend to make their voices heard on the issue.
This is the first time that Mr. Museveni, in his political life, has faced a formidable opponent who scares him to his roots. So this is why we see a lot of excitement in the politics of Uganda this time around. And secondly, this is why we see signs that Mr. Museveni is uncomfortable and jittery, and he has actually instituted a state-inspired intimidation program meant to deter the formidability of Mr. Mbabazi and other credible opposition.
As they go into elections next month, does Mr. Mbabazi feel like this has been a credible process?
It is definitely not a credible process, and Mr. Mbabazi knows about it. He outed a document recently, and within that document, he outlined the characteristics of state-inspired brutality against his supporters and all those other people allied to him. So definitely Mr. Mbabazi is aware, as all other Ugandans are, that there is no level playing field.
Let's talk a little bit about the Ugandan diaspora here in North America and other parts of the world. How engaged is the Ugandan diaspora in these elections as opposed to the previous ones?
Yeah, the Ugandan diaspora is very engaged. And this is ironical because this time around, the Ugandan diaspora has been dispossessed or it has been disenfranchised by Mr. Museveni's government. As you may be aware, the Ugandan diaspora is not going to take part in voting. But again, it is kind of ironical that the Ugandan diaspora is so much preoccupied with this election process.
So what kind of influence can you wield in an election if you're not going to vote?
Again, if you dig a little deeper, you will find a ready explanation. And that is, as you may be aware, the Ugandan diaspora is the second most important source or remittance, you know, for foreign resources in terms of remittances. So that being the case, the Ugandan people in the diaspora are very interested in knowing where their money is going and ensuring that there is freedom back home. And another thing is, when they invest, they would wish to go back home and spend some time with their people. But they don't want to go back home And as soon as they leave the airport, it's all dark. The lights have stopped. And as soon as they hit the roads, they are not sure whether they are guaranteed to reach home because the roads are so narrow and so bad quality that they could die on them. And they don't want to go back home and find that their loved ones cannot access treatment in the hospitals. So our people are very, very interested in what is going on back home.
Now, obviously, you have family members back in Uganda. What are they telling you about the process? How excited are they about going into next month for the elections?
It is two-way. People are both excited and apprehensive. I'll tell you that. They are excited because they know, because the candidates have told them, and especially Mr. Mbabazi, that the power to change the status quo is within your hands. It's within your vote. So go and vote. Because our campaign and Mr. Mbabazi's strategy always has been to get the vote out. So people are excited that they're going to vote and change the status quo. But again, they are apprehensive.
Martin Byakureka is a Ugandan activist based in Boston. It is now time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Jackson. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Captain Jacques Tuyisenge scored in the 49th minute to lift hosts Rwanda to a 1-0 victory over the Democratic Republic of Congo in a friendly match played in Gishenyi on Sunday. Elsewhere, Ethiopia and Niger drew 1-1 in Addis Ababa as Gabon came from behind to hold hosts Uganda to a 1-1 draw in Njeru, some 80 kilometers east of the Ugandan capital Kampala. These teams are gearing up for the African Nations Championship starting in Kigali, Rwanda next Saturday. Here in South Africa, Nigeria play Ivory Coast in the capital Tshwane today, Monday. Nigeria has held a training camp here preparing for the African Nations Championship. I caught up with the Nigeria Super Eagles coach, Sunday Olise, who sheds light on why they opted for this training venue.
Well, so far so good. We came here because we wanted to use up some altitude and also at the same time to have some quiet training sessions. So far it's been okay. We've had some knocks, but we're still not ready. The tournament is on the 18th, not today. But we're just praying that come the 18th, when we play our first game, we'll be ready to play. It all boils down to serving our country. So all we just want to do is just build our team. Our ambitions are just to be very competitive and give these players a chance to show what they can do to the world. That's it. And for us, it's going to be a very, very competitive tournament. So we'll take it as it comes. And we have a very young team. So.
That was Sunday Olise, coach of the Nigeria Super Eagles, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. Meanwhile, the 2016 African Nations Championship hosts, Rwanda, are the most improved African team, while Namibia has slipped by the widest margin according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland. Placed 19th, African champions Ivory Coast are the highest-ranked team on the continent. Algeria is 28th, Ghana 33rd, Cape Verde Islands 39th, Tunisia 40th, Senegal 45th, Republic of Congo 48th, Guinea 49th, Cameroon 57th, and Egypt 58th. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. That is it for this Monday, January the 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloti and Ricky Shryok, as well as sports editor Mark Owuma, I'm Jackson Vunganyi, wishing you a pleasant day.
Next on Let's Talk. Aging. Are you ready for it? Are you saving enough money for it? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing aging. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Hearted show covers